Hi, friends. My name is Trish, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Trish.
My home group is the Tuesday Night For Now group of Narcotics Anonymous in Grand Prairie, Alberta, Canada. And my clean date is December 2nd, 1989. I'm in London for 13 nights. I leave on Tuesday. I was also born in Grand Prairie, and I left for about 11 years, but I came back there. And I'm a pretty typical Canadian. One grandfather was Irish, one grandfather was Scottish, one grandmother was Norwegian, and one grandmother was Danish-German. Pretty typical Canadian. I'm the oldest of seven kids. My mom was the oldest, well, the third youngest of 10. My dad is the oldest of seven. And that played a big factor, I think, in the way I grew up. Being a big sister really made me feel like I was always responsible. And my mother had seven kids in 10 years, and then she had a nervous breakdown. And when I was 13 is when the nervous breakdown happened, and she attempted suicide by slashing her wrists. And my dad and I were the only two that knew about it. And a couple of days later, my aunt and my dad sat me down, and they said, "You know, Patricia, this might not have happened if you'd done more work around the house." And I think in a lot of ways, that's where part of my workaholism came. Whenever I was under any kind of stress, I became a human doing instead of a human being. And I always wanted to do and not feel. I come from a family that both through my dad's family and my mom's family, there's alcoholics and addicts on both sides of the family. In fact, the way we ended up in northern Alberta is my grandfather was a terrible drunk, so his father paid for the family to go 1,000 miles north as far as the railway ended in 1919 to get him as far away from the house as the family as possible. So that's how I ended up being born in Grand Prairie, because of addiction. So because I grew up knowing about addiction and alcoholism, I said it's never going to happen to me. I'm not going to be like that. And I was good at school, and organizing things mentally seemed to give me some relief from panic. And being able to accomplish things in school made me feel like I wasn't totally responsible for everything going bad in the world. So I graduated from high school, and I went to a year at college in my hometown, and then went into the capital city in Edmonton. And I almost unexpectedly got accepted into law school early. So I went, and I graduated from law school in 1978, and I articled, and I got admitted to the bar in 1979. And in Alberta, you become both a barrister and a solicitor. And at the end of a couple of years, 3 years, I said, "I don't like this. I don't like this at all. People are paying me to fight each other. I feel like I'm part of the problem in the world, not part of the solution. I'm a little bit young to be a hippie. I was born in 1952, but you have to realize that the 60s didn't get to northern Alberta until the 70s. And so that was part of, I wanted to be part of the solution. So I quit practicing law. And you know, until that point, well, I had just been a binger in my use. It was nothing for me to go 6 or 9 months between using, because the example of my family was such that I didn't want to be like that. But it seemed as though once I decided that I wasn't going to be a member of the bar anymore, I developed what is known in Canadian as a fuck it attitude. Nothing mattered. I think for me, my devotion to the whole study of law had been like my higher power for about 10 years. I had just thrown my whole life into it and devoted everything to it. And when the fantasy faded away, and I felt like it was awful and dirty, and it made me feel like I was making the world a better place, I think that's when I really found out I had no coping skills. And I really didn't care what happened to me. Now, my addiction manifests itself in my life in mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Mentally, I obsess. For instance, if somebody says something, like my sister said to me one day, "You know, Patricia, that outfit almost looks nice on you." Well, I'll obsess about that. I'll obsess and obsess at 3 a.m. And the same as I used to do when I was working. And so I began actually using as a way to sleep. This is not part of the family disease, you understand. This is medication, sleeping medication. I need to sleep to be productive. And so for a while, that's how I justified it. But I would be, the obsessions would always be there. So the mental part of my disease is the obsessive thinking. The emotional part of my disease is that I overreact. I really overreact. Like around the time I was 30, and that's when I fired my secretary, divorced my husband, quit practicing law, gave away my court robes and my court books and my wall hangings and my everything else I owned, packed what was left in my car, drove 300 miles away and sold the car. I just needed a change, you understand. And that's a little bit of overreacting. And I still can do that. I want to warn you, I want to tell you right now, I am not like this anymore. The following story is from my past. So the meeting was over, it was an NA meeting, and I was helping clear away tables. And this fellow had been bugging me, you know, for weeks. He kept coming up and poking me in the ribs. Well, I don't like being poked in the ribs, but I have a really bad startle reaction. And so that's why he would come up and poke me in the ribs. So I was really, this had been a fabulous guest speaker that night. I was emotionally so open. He comes up behind me and he pokes me in the ribs. I grab him by the neck of his shirt. I kick his legs out from under him. I throw him on the ground. I jump on top of him and I start pounding his head into the floor. "Are you sorry? Are you sorry?" That's what I mean by overreacting. And so that's mentally and that's emotionally. Physically, I get cravings. Now, in recovery, sometimes the cravings can definitely change. Like about a year ago, I went for a job interview and I came out and I was just drained. And all of a sudden, this craving came over me to go shopping. And I knew that if I didn't get to a meeting, I was probably going to be about $1,200 poorer. That I couldn't afford to. It's a weird, like I have to be very careful of cravings, even in recovery. It's as though my favorite drug has turned into more of almost anything. And so I have to go to meetings and I have to practice my program. And the spiritual part of my disease, although I didn't know it at the time, was that I was lonely. The very first apartment building that had been built in my hometown, it was 3 stories high. It was huge. And I can remember sitting on the curb when I was about 12, looking at the lights that were lit, wondering what the people's lives were like in there, sitting in the dark, wishing that I could be in there and that I could feel being part of that brightly lit place. And so when I finally started coming to Narcotics Anonymous, I felt as though I had actually been a fish that had been imprisoned on land. And I finally understood that my natural milieu had never been in my life. I fit here. Like, this really works for me. It just really suits me. And so I have trouble with the God part. I think, if I was to describe it, I'm an atheist, feminist, pagan. I think that might be what I am. So the whole God thing has been a problem for me. I like this one woman I met on the internet recovery. Her higher power's name is Fred. Faith in recovery, empowered daily. And she turns her will and her life over to the care of Fred every day. And I like things like that, like G-O-D, good orderly direction. I like to feel like maybe I'll just turn my will and my life over to the care of all the positive energy that's in the room tonight. And I find that works for me. And so I turned my will and my life, I tried to turn my will and my life over. I relapsed when I was 14 months clean. And so that's when I really realized I totally didn't just understand powerlessness here. I kind of understood it at a gut level. I didn't want to relapse. I honestly didn't. It was like I just got caught up in old people, places, and things or something like that. And so I came back with a new determination and a new commitment. Before, I had hoped to make recovery just kind of like another hobby that you just pick up when you need a break. But today, I need it to live. And I'm happy to have it to live. So mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically, I like the fact that in this program there are no rules. Like, I don't speak for Narcotics Anonymous. You honestly don't base your opinion of Narcotics Anonymous in Canada on me, right? I'm only me. You take what you like and you leave the rest. I also happen to believe that there are many paths up the mountain. I don't happen to believe that Narcotics Anonymous is the only way to recover. Now, what's happened to me in recovery is that I've settled down. Like, that might sound really bizarre, or it might sound like big deal, but it seemed like I would have these thunder, lightning, electrical storms that would build up under my skin, and I'd be good, and I'd be good, and I'd be good, and I'd be good, and pow! All of a sudden, I have to go screw my brains out, smoke my brains out, drink my brains out. There, I feel better. And sometimes, instead of doing that, I would change men, jobs, cars, or cities. So now what's happened to me in recovery is that I've worked for the same agency now since 1998. It's a miracle. People in my hometown can't even believe it. Where are you working now, Trish? Oh, still at the same place. And it's amazing for me that I've been able to do that, because I've always been good at beginnings. I've always been good at endings. Not very good at middles. And I went through the whole 13-stepping, we call it in Canada, where you date other people in the program. And yeah, probably I dated a few vulnerable newcomers. Well, in fact, you could even describe my husband as a newcomer, because when we moved in together, I had 5 years and he had 6 months. So I'm not one of those people that tells you that you should wait a year before you get into a relationship. Like, who am I to say that, right? I can't. And we're still together. And to tell you what a wonderful man he is in recovery, he's shorter than me, lighter than me, younger than me, has less formal education than me, and less clean time than me, and we're really happy together. We don't have those power struggles, which I mostly attribute to him. He considered himself to be really a hard addict. If you're gonna use, just stick your head in the toilet. Not a binger like me. However, after we lived together for a while, he said, it's really clear to me you're sicker than me and you need more meetings than me. And so today he sees that you don't judge people by what or how much they used or who their connections were. Because we all are so individual. We're so individual, and where we come from and why we used and how we used. I hope that there's something in my program, or pardon me, in what I've said tonight, that will speak to some of you, but I also know you may not relate at all. And if not, just keep coming back. I've discovered about myself, I found out who Trish is by listening to your stories. I think I was shut down most of my life. And all of a sudden, somebody will tell me, they'll tell me part of how they felt that day, and I'll say, oh my God, I'm just like Mickey. I never knew that. I didn't have that inside of me. I was just such a thinker and organizer that I don't think I had feelings. I didn't like feelings, you know. They're kind of messy. I thought they were very unproductive. I grew up in a family that ran a grocery store, and so we felt that anything that didn't contribute to the gross national product was not useful. Feelings? And so I've really found in Narcotics Anonymous what feelings are, how to have them, how to deal with them. And one of the most important things I've learned is how not to listen to them, because I can also have extreme overreactions. Let's suppose it could be at home and I get home after traveling and both bathrooms are dirty. And I think, all right, what are those guys doing? Because my husband has a roommate staying with him while I'm traveling. And they think it's a woman's work, cleaning bathrooms. And I'll go into the bathroom and I'll say, it's just, I hate this. And they know that. And they're treating me badly. And it's like the story of my life. Nobody ever takes me seriously. Nobody's really ever loved me. They don't even really know who I am. And I can come out of the bathroom being a complete mess in those overreactions. And so one of the things I've learned in recovery is my feelings lie to me. I'll have days where I feel like I am a piece of shit. I am not King Midas, where everything I touch turns to gold. I am Queen Shit. Everything I touch turns to shit. And I'll actually believe that. But this program has taught me, you know what, Trish? You might be dehydrated. You might need a good night's sleep. You might have low blood sugar. Please don't listen to those feelings. Maybe, you know, drink some water, eat a well-balanced meal, get some fresh air, go to a meeting. My feelings lie to me, and I can't act on them. I have to really be careful about them. I have to often check them out with my sponsor. And my sponsor, who is 20 years clean, she lives on a, in the summers, she lives in a forestry tower. This is a very different life than what you're used to. She lives 80 kilometers south of town in the middle of the woods. On the top, she spends her days on the top of an 80-foot forestry tower watching the forest for forest fires. And in the winter, she goes to the city, and she's an artist. And she's the one that taught me this about my feelings can lie to me. That is, to me, has been one of the most useful pieces of advice I've ever gotten. Because my feelings used to dictate what I did. I can remember my father coming to me, and he just watched a show on Oprah, and he said, you know, Patricia, I realize that we come from a dysfunctional family. And it's partly my fault you're such a failure. Well, you know, in the old days I could have used that. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but you use at somebody. They hurt you, so you use at them. And I could have used that as an excuse. But today I have to take total responsibility for how I feel. And that if I'm feeling really shitty or angry or resentful, I need to do something about it. You don't need to change your behavior. The world doesn't need to change. I need to change. And that has completely transformed my life. I used to be quite into agitation and propaganda and petitioning the government and everything. But today, I have a big enough project ahead of me. I'm just working on myself. This is a lifelong dream I'm doing right now. I've taken a year off work and I'm traveling. And for somebody who hasn't traveled a whole lot, it's pretty wonderful. And it's one of the gifts of recovery. I'd like to thank you all very much for having me here tonight to share. God bless.